European Division and the Political Intelligence Department of Foreign Service in the Middle East. And she worked particularly on Yugoslavian affairs in the Intelligence Department of the War Office. She was visiting professor at Simon Fraser in 1966, visiting professor at Stanford in 1968, and she has visited Yugoslavia, her particular specialty, most years since 1945. She's a writer and broadcaster on Yugoslavian affairs. She has interviewed Tito twice and met him on a number of occasions. And she has written the, among other books on Yugoslavia, her most recent is a biography of Tito himself, which is printed by Longmans in 1970 and is now in Penguin since 1974. I understand that it hasn't been yet printed in Yugoslavia. But it has been, there are editions in most European languages. I think, therefore, that you'll agree with me that our guest is fully well qualified to speak to us, as she will this evening, on Tito and world communism. Great pleasure introducing to you Mrs. Auti.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Institute, and friends, shortment.
Can you shorten? How do we do shorten?
I don't know how we shorten it. Can't shorten it. I'll hold it. Is that all right? Yes, right. Mr. Chairman, members of the Institute, it's a great pleasure and a great honor to me to be invited to speak here tonight, especially since I think it possible that I've been invited here on false pretenses. False pretenses, not exactly on my part, but when I came to see the brochure of the Institute, I saw that it said that I had been a parachutist during the Second World War. But in fact, I never was a parachutist. And this is a story that I have been trying to kill for a very long time, and it still comes back and hits me in the teeth. And I would like to deny it now. The only parachuting I have done is that I seem to have been parachuted from the top of Burnaby Mountain into the campus at UBC. And I hope that you will not find this too much of a disappointment. So I would now like to talk about Tito as a revolutionary leader. And examine his career, not so much in the light of the myths of history, of which this parachuting incident is only one, but by trying to disentangle fact from fiction in his career and see how a man who came from one of the poorest villages in the country of Yugoslavia, which at that time was not even Yugoslavia, should become the leader of an international form of communism and the leader of Yugoslavia today. Tito today is 84 years old, rising 85. He's been president of a communist republic in Yugoslavia for over 30 years. He's the oldest, the only surviving head of state who was a leader in the Second World War. He's a revered elder statesman with a world reputation, quite disproportionate to the size and importance of the relatively small Balkan country which he rules, if I may use that word. I'm sure he would not like it. If you look at his life history, his career is far stranger than fiction. He was born into a poor Catholic, and I stress Catholic family, Roman Catholic family, in the Croatian province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he has lived to become the leader of, an outstanding leader in the world, and to create the concept of the third world, which he himself, a concept that he himself created in order to try and let small countries in the second half of the 20th century have some kind of influence on global politics. As we see, as we shall see, maybe he didn't altogether succeed in this big ambition. But he consorts today with leaders of the United States, with leaders of the Soviet Union. Even President Giscard d'Estaing went to meet to visit him recently. He can presumably have whatever luxury and riches he wants. And if not all powerful in Yugoslavia, he certainly has an influence that no one's ever had before in that country and is unlikely ever to have again, as far as I can see, in the future. Now, how did this transformation come about? Well, the question is not so much what makes a revolutionary leader as what made this revolutionary leader, what turned Tito to revolution in the first place. And then how did he become a revolutionary leader of world importance on an international level? You see, Yugoslavia before the First World War, when Tito was born, was a backward, conservative, mainly peasant, non-industrialized country with few industrial workers, the most unlikely setting for a communist leader, for a world communist leader to spring from. And if you look at Tito's childhood and family background, there's little to indicate that he would end up as a world leader. Can I be heard up there? Is that all right?
No, not very well.
Would you like me to speak louder?
Yes.
Is that better? Right. From what I've been able to discover about his childhood, he was not a rebel. He was never a rebel as a boy, not even a rebel in his own family. Perhaps he was the most determined of all the children in his family to succeed. He was what you might call an ambitious conformist, anxious to rise to the top of the society in which he found himself, and always a bit of a leader in a small group. He was born in Croatia, which at that time was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It was a part that was ruled from Hungary, and he was Croatian-speaking, Slavonic-speaking, though he spoke German equally as being the language of Austria. He has never admitted to speaking Hungarian, speaking Magyar, though I suspect he understands it and, if pushed, could speak it. His family was poor and very Catholic, his mother very devout. And Tito himself was baptized and received his first communion in the Catholic Church. He served as an acolyte and he enjoyed it and didn't give it up until the police, till the priest, that was a bad slip, wasn't it? till the priest boxed his ears. And then his pride was offended, and so he didn't do that anymore. But the region where he lived, poverty was endemic. And there was a long tradition of peasant revolt, and I suspect revolt against really gross oppression. And I suspect that it was this folk memory that he was brought up in that was the strongest radical influence on his youth. And that it was the poverty that he was brought up in, which, and the limited conditions of village life, which made him ambitious to get on and get out. and gave him the ideals that he had in later life to get rid of poverty in the society that he was trying to build in Yugoslavia. The village was poor right through until today, where now, of course, it makes a certain amount of tourist capital out of Tito, being Tito's birthplace, but it was a very poor village, though his family was not the poorest. But he knew what hunger was, he knew what poverty was, and he didn't have enough money to get properly educated, nor enough even to emigrate to the United States or Canada, which at one stage he contemplated doing. He did get out. He did what his brothers before him had done. Nothing unusual in this. He went to the nearest big town and became an apprentice mechanic. And it was through this kind of training, which was on a very low level, that he was introduced into the trade union movement, and this gave him his first contact with political organized political life. He went into the trade union movement, which was part of the Social Democrat Party in the German tradition at that time, in order to give him protection in times of unemployment. And he wanted at this time to be what in Middle Europe is called an engineer. And that can mean anything from a bicycle mechanic to an engineer in the sense that we would describe it today. But he always liked to think of it on the higher level. And it's interesting that when he came to have to take up disguises and aliases, it was the alias of an engineer, of Engineer Tomanek, that he acted out his early ambitions. Well, as a young man, he traveled all over the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and that meant parts of today's Czechoslovakia, parts of Italy, Vienna, and then he went on to industrial places in Germany, so that he learnt, even before he was 18, to get around, how to get around in Europe. And he had what Russian leaders have never had, and many of the leaders of East European communist countries, he had a knowledge of the, and a background of the cultural development of Western Europe, and of the cities of Western Europe, and of the attitudes of Western Europe. He really was a Western Slav, and he knew what Europe was like, which you can't say for Stalin or Brezhnev or many of the other communist leaders. And it's an interesting commentary on his character that all this time he was not in rebellion against the existing social conditions, although he was suffering from them and no doubt critical of them. But and when his time came to be drafted into the military, he went back home in order to join up, in order to do his draft. And he did his military service before the First World War, and he enjoyed it. And he became an NCO, and quite an outstanding NCO at that. He did well. And he liked responsibility, and he got as far as somebody with his poor background could do. Then came the First World War, and this, of course, really changed his life, because it provided a major education and a permanent influence and experiences which gave him opportunities which otherwise he would never have had. He was sent to the Eastern Front as part of the Austro-Hungarian army, of the Austrian army, to fight on the Kaiser's side against the Russians, and fighting the Russian troops, Cossack troops on the Eastern Front. He was wounded, and so severely wounded that he very nearly died. It was one of his early lucky escapes, of which he was to have many in his life. He then spent about 5 years in Russia, partly as a prisoner of war, prisoner of war camps, partly on the run in Siberia when he escaped. He visited St. Petersburg during 1917, the important years of the development of the revolution. He never went to Moscow, and after the outbreak of the revolution, when prisoners of war were freed, he served as a guard on the Trans-Siberian Railway, supporting the Red Army. I would say that this was about as near as he came to consorting with Bolsheviks. I think perhaps that is true. It is, however, said that he obtained a party ticket at this time with the Bolshevik Party, and some papers have been produced to prove this. If so, I would have said myself that it was Tito taking the opportunity to Tito's instinct for self-preservation, that he thought that a party ticket was important to have at that time. When he left Russia at the end of the war, he went back to Croatia. He was in charge of, as usual, in charge of a small group. He was NCO, and he went back to his own home village, taking with him a Russian girl whom he'd married in an Orthodox church, incidentally, and taking with him also, I think, a tremendous impression of the Russian Revolution. I think this was perhaps most important, that he had seen the bottom ranks of society overturn as the Tsarist Empire, do the impossible. And I think he carried this with him. And when it came to the Second World War, I think he decided that he could do likewise. When he went back home, he had high hopes of, he was the traveled man, he was the man who had been in Russia, he spoke perfect Russian, he'd been the NCO, he had all sorts of marvelous stories to tell, and he came back to terrible disillusionment. No jobs, total chaos, a wife and three, four children in 4 years, and impossible to keep them. It's my belief if he'd got a good job at this time in the new society, he would never be where he is today. But he couldn't get a job, and eventually he got a job which was a very poor job, and which was the job that he always took, I notice, when he wanted to, when he was in desperate circumstances. He was a mechanic for a flour mill, and in the country. And there he lived with his wife and told stories to people who came. And he was bored, and he was earning very little. And his life was restricted, and his ambitions totally frustrated. And it was at this moment, 1925, when he was visited by an agent from the Comintern. Significant, I think, that the agent that the Comintern sent, or it may have been pure chance, one is not able to know, that the man they sent to recruit Tito at this time was an aristocrat who had been an officer in the Austrian army. And he was able to talk Tito into joining the banned Yugoslav Communist Party and doing underground work for them. And this is how Tito was politically recruited. And this is not the way that a rebel goes into politics. So he was recruited, so he was given jobs like distributing leaflets illegally, fomenting strikes, setting up trade unions and that sort of thing. And eventually orders from Moscow came that they were to go over to more active work and they were to start throwing bombs. So Tito got a few bombs, had them in his lodgings. The police, of course, had caught up with him by this time, and he was eventually arrested and had a 6 years jail sentence. And by this time, he had no way back. By this time, he'd been drawn into underground, illegal communist politics. His years in prison were, as a political prisoner, turned him into a hardened communist. They were very important. He became a professional political worker at this time. It taught him about international communism and the career that that could offer to those whom Moscow selected for training. It brought him into contact with top Yugoslav communists and others, agents of the Comintern, and with a man called Moshe Piade, who was a brilliant Sephardic Jew from a rich Yugoslav family, who was himself a real revolutionary, who had gone in by a different route from Tito. And Moshe Piade, I believe, was Tito's guru, if that's the right concept. He was the man who had an enormous influence over Tito, who taught him how such communist ideology as he absorbed, and gave him ideals and instructed him and helped him with practical advice, and died too soon to be of use to Tito now. So that when Tito came out of jail, he was trained, he was more educated, he was more mature, and he was a hardened party worker. Prison had been a comparatively safe place compared with the jungle of international politics that he went out to. Ambition had told him that he must go to Moscow, and he managed to get himself nominated to go and be trained in Moscow and work for the Comintern. I suppose he didn't know what he was going into, because when he arrived, and shortly after he arrived in Moscow, Stalin's great purge began. And he was thrown into, at the deep end, as you might say, into this terrible life that the international communists led, working for the Comintern. But Tito, you see, had a lot of advantages. He spoke perfect Russian, which meant he could understand what was being said about him, which was not true of a lot of the others who were there. Togliatti, for instance, never did learn to speak Russian properly or to understand it well. But Tito was absolutely could deal with that. He could speak perfect German, so that he could get on with most of the international communists there. And he had a native instinct for self-preservation, together with a peasant's shrewdness and caution, and all the things that he had learned as a political prisoner. And he kept a very low profile. He was living in a great hotel, a huge hotel called the Hotel Lux. And he stayed in his room and he worked hard. And he made the right friends. He made friends with Georgi Dimitrov, who'd been the Bulgarian communist who tried to frame for the burning of the Reichstag in Germany and had failed, and who was a kind of a hero, the great communist hero of the 30s. He made great friends with him, and so he had protection. But at the same time, he was frightfully careful. According to his own accounts, and I see no reason to doubt this at all. I know that somebody told me that once his son, Jarko, who was a son by the Russian girl that he'd taken back to Croatia, who'd gone back to live in Russia after he'd been in jail, that Jarko rushed into Tito's room in the Hotel Lux at one stage and started saying, you know, so-and-so's been arrested and so-and-so's been arrested. And Tito grabbed him by the arm and took him out and walked him in the park, because Tito was aware that everything was bugged, not only his own room, but the showers. They only had warm water once a week tepid at that, and so little of it that they all had to gather together under the showers. And this was the time when they exchanged gossip about who'd been arrested. And but Tito had the sense to know that even the showers were bugged, so that it was no good thinking that the noise of the shower would drown what was being whispered there. He was one of the newest, he was one of the least important, and he was one of the quietest Yugoslavs in the Comintern. And this is probably why he survived and was not purged. He's certainly terrified, certainly knew that he was caught up in a world from which there was no escape, but at the same time he could measure himself up against the other members of the Comintern who were there, and he probably realized that he was as intelligent as most of the people, and that he had a lot more nous and capacity for survival than the others had. And above all, he had this chameleon-like capacity for fading into the background. There were all sorts of things he could have done in Moscow at that time, which he refused to do. He wouldn't go and train at the Lenin School, and he wouldn't give lectures. He said, no, he was too new, he must learn his stuff first. And it's quite clear that he felt that that to keep a low profile was to survive, and he survived. He got out of Moscow eventually, and I think by this time he was ambitious, and he wanted to be secretary of the Yugoslav Party. The secretary who had been at work for 5 years or more than that, had been liquidated by Stalin, and most of the others had been shot too, and there weren't many Yugoslavs left. But there were, and it's very surprising that in these conditions there were other contenders for the job too, and Tito had to fight for it. But he fought like a tiger. He had the support of Moshe Piade in Yugoslavia, and he had the support of Dimitrov inside the Comintern. And one way and another, he gradually made himself so indispensable that he was appointed as Secretary General. During this time, whilst this fight was going on, he was traveling about Europe. And he did far more traveling than is normal amongst East European leaders. He lived in Paris for quite a long time. He traveled a lot in France. He was organizing recruits for the International Brigade in Spain, in the Spanish Civil War. And then part of the time did this most dangerous thing of going back to Yugoslavia, where a price was on, where he was, there was an arrest out for him all the time, and descriptions of him. He knew that his enemies in the Yugoslav Party, other people who wanted to, were backing the other candidates, were notifying the Yugoslav police whenever he was due to arrive in Yugoslavia, and they were giving secret information about his travel papers and so on, so that he always had to be one step ahead and go by some other route. He had not only to defeat the Yugoslav police and his enemies in the Comintern, he had to defeat his enemies in the Yugoslav Communist Party as well. And so he had to be pretty astute. And as you see, he succeeded in doing it. Inside Yugoslavia, it was very dangerous, because he was known to be by this time to be a dangerous Comintern agent. But what did he do? He had immense histrionic talent. He set himself up as an engineer, and the most senior kind of engineer. He had a Ford car, which in those days, with a chauffeur, which in those days was really quite something. He traveled by first class on the train or by air. All this was done, of course, with the aid of Communist Party members. Beautiful clothes tailored by a communist tailor, air tickets obtained from a communist who had friends in the airline, and so on, and so on. But he calculated that the Yugoslav police were looking for somebody who was scruffy. I won't say long-haired and bearded, but the 1930s equivalent of that, you know. At this time, he was building up an underground party with contacts and cells all over Yugoslavia, and he was picking out people to be his supporters all over the country. And he picked out at this time some people who are still with him. Bakaric, still with him, leader in Croatia. Kardel, still with him, leader in Slovenia. And the man I would have said, if there was going to be somebody after Tito, might have been the man, but I'm afraid he's suffering from cancer and it will not be available. Mate, still with him. And then there are those who are not still with him, who had a different political development, like Milovan Djilas and Rankovic, and those who died, like Piade. But it's interesting that he picked then the group who stayed with him throughout the war. How was he living at this time? What did they live off? What did they use for money? Well, they got some money from Moscow, but less and less. So that by the time war broke out in 1939, Tito had built the party, and he was getting money from bourgeois, from industrialists, from professional people, and from newspaper proprietors. He was getting almost enough money inside Yugoslavia to run the party, so that when the Second World War actually came, he was in a position to be independent, at any rate on the financial level. He was not dependent on Moscow for money. So by this time he was able to follow an independent line. And the independent line he chose to follow was two things. One, to fight the Germans, not only in guerrilla attack, and this is something that's unique to Tito. He decided to set up an army to fight guerrilla war. And by an army, I mean an army with the regular formal organization of an army. And he started this when he could only do it on paper. He moved on to an army with manpower, and ultimately he moved on to an army that was armed and organized and trained, and that was comparable with, perhaps not the highest troops, but with most of the other, certainly comparable with the Italian army. He was organizing a power base for his second objective, and his second objective was a political revolution in Yugoslavia at the end of the war. So during the war, he was doing two things. He was fighting the Germans, and he was fighting a civil war at the same time in order to be in a position to take over power when the war ended. Now, neither Churchill nor Roosevelt, and probably not Stalin at first, had a political objective for the end of the war that was as clear as this. Tito, from the beginning, knew exactly what he wanted to do, and he kept his two objectives in front of him all the time. On the political side, from September 1941, he started to organize local committees in what were called liberated areas. That was in the areas behind the enemy's line, which the enemy could not put his troops into because they could only cover the lines of communication in the main towns. And so in the liberated areas, he got committees of local people, led by communists, dealing with local government, education committees, health committees, taxation committees, food committees, you name it, they had it in local government. And if the enemy came and occupied that area, then the committee folded up and they waited until the enemy had gone. But by the end of the war, he had committees dealing with civilian government, as well as military government, in all areas of the country. And in the towns that he hadn't controlled, he had underground committees, so that there was a political structure already at the end of the war. The revolution was virtually completed by the end of the war. He also, from an early stage, from 1942, That was before we could even see daylight in the Second World War and know that victory was assured. He had an idea that his movement, communist-led, must be accepted as the de facto government in Yugoslavia. He put this idea to Stalin. Stalin slapped it down. On no account do it. Stalin was terrified that it would offend the Allies and they wouldn't mount the Second Front. So Stalin stamped on that. Tito, okay, he'd been ordered not to do it, so he didn't do it in 1942. Exactly a year later, in November 1943, he decided that he would try the same thing again. This time, he informed Stalin after he had done it. And so from 1943, November, he had charge of a de facto government, and he had this network and he of political committees, and he was building up a very well-drilled, very well-disciplined, very well-organized army. And by the end of the war, he had an army of, they claim, 800,000. I think it may be a bit blown up by a lot of women, apart from anything else. But they claim to have 800,000 people bearing arms. And he had a power base from which he could talk to the Allies. He could persuade Stalin not to occupy Yugoslavia. And he could work independently. And it was this long-distance political acumen, as well as a brilliant capacity for organization, as well as a charismatic character, that made him dominate all other people so that nobody challenged his authority during the war. It was this that made him an accepted leader at the end of the war. Now, there was an awful lot of propaganda went with it, an awful lot of myth-making. I could go into that endlessly, but I mustn't do it because you want to know a little bit about Yugoslavia afterwards, about Tito as a revolutionary leader once he had got there. And he was, I think, unchallengeable by the end of the war. Now, if we come to look at post-war Yugoslavia, it was easy for him, in a way, to effect the post-war revolution in the sense of getting into power. They had seized power. And this was confirmed by a popular vote that may have been managed somewhat, but was undoubtedly a genuine acceptance. And there was nobody to challenge the communists in government in 1945. And from then on, then came the difficulties. Then they had to set up a state that they were not competent to do. Up to this time, Tito had been encapsulated in a small world, which he understood, in Yugoslavia, fighting, organizing a small army. After this, he wanted to be accepted as an independent leader. He had to set up a state. He had to fight off counter-revolution from all sides. He had to fight off the Russians who were trying to take over. And set up a state, and he was not, he had no experience for this, and none of his supporters had. So what did they do? Of course, they tried to make a mini model of the Soviet Union, the only model they had. They tried to copy the Soviet Union, and they said, we will nationalize industries, we will industrialize, we will set up a large army, and we will have a constitution like the Soviet Union. And so they tried to copy the Soviet Union. They said the Soviet Union must help us because we are the communist states. We have done so well and we deserve help. He had no conception of the fact that what he had done was not what the Russians wanted him to do. They did not want an independent Yugoslavia. They were frightened that it would endanger their relations with the Western allies. They didn't want an independent leader making the kind of government. They didn't want Yugoslavia to have an independent army. They didn't want it to industrialize. What do you want industries for, said Molotov? We've got plenty in Russia. And they wanted the Yugoslav army disbanded, and they wanted to reorganize it along lines that they disapproved of. They disapproved entirely of a guerrilla army. It was too dangerous. And they started giving Tito his orders. Tito felt he was head of state now, he was not a Comintern agent, and that he should be treated differently. And he also, they thought, was getting too big for his boots, which perhaps he was, thinking that perhaps he could organize the other communist countries of Eastern Europe and show them how to set about doing the job that he thought he was doing very well. And Stalin, of course, needless to say, didn't go down well with him. And Stalin decided that Tito must be brought to heel. In order to do this, Stalin set up an organization to take the place of the Comintern, which had been abolished in 1943, and this was called the Cominform. And the Cominform, I believe, was founded in order to crush Tito. The critical point came when Stalin ordered Tito to order the Yugoslav party to get rid of Tito as their head, and Tito had to decide whether to give in to Stalin or to cut himself away from Russia and become independent. This was the moment of truth. This was the turning point in his whole career. And it was at this point that his independence, his courage, his capacity to gamble, I think, as a gambler, came to the fore. He discussed it with other Yugoslav leaders. They knew perfectly well there were people in Yugoslavia who didn't support them, but they equally knew that the non-communists did support them. One thing the non-communists didn't want was Russia in Yugoslavia. They'd rather have Tito than that. And he got enough support from the party, and so they defied Stalin. And this is what will make Tito's reputation throughout history. He showed that Stalin could be defied. In fact, it was Tito's own decision, and it was a tremendously courageous decision to make. And it was the big independent decision that determined the rest of his career and changed the face of international communism. Now, that was 1948. It was one thing to decide to defy Stalin. It was another thing to get away with it. And it wasn't until Stalin died that he really knew that he had got away with it. He got away with it because the West gave Tito economic aid. The Russians tried to boycott them economically, and they might have succeeded. But England, and even more, the United States of America, and to some extent France, but big aid from the United States of America saved Tito. It saved them from economic ruin, which would have turned the people against him. Starvation might have been the one thing that would have altered the situation. They were saved from starvation. And more than that, they were given enough money to arm themselves against Stalin, to industrialize, to experiment with communism, and this is what went on for the next 25 years. This is what has been happening in Yugoslavia since 1950. And it's there have been big changes in Yugoslavia since 1950, which have been an experiment in an alternative form of communism. They call it socialism. You may call it communism. Tito says communism can never be achieved because communism is a final stage. But experimentation anyway in some form of socialism or communism. And what did they do? They had to carry on their experiments, which were started in about 1951, always against the threat from Russia. As long as Stalin was alive, there were attempts on Tito's life, which didn't succeed, and everything was done to try and break Yugoslavia without success. Once he was dead, and affairs got into the hand of Khrushchev, the Russians decided that perhaps appeasement of Yugoslavia was the best thing. And in 1955, they went to Belgrade to apologize and say, well, it wasn't us, really, and it wasn't really Stalin. He didn't mean it, and we didn't mean it, and let's all be friends and get back to where we started from. And Tito said, not so. It was rather cold, and negotiated very sharply with the Russians. Khrushchev, I remember, got very gay and pretended it was a big party and pretended or actually was very drunk and that they were all being happy Slavonic brothers together. But Tito was very, very hard and rather bad-tempered all the time. And when the negotiations came to an end, Tito had bargained with the Russians. He would be on better relations with them, but only on his own terms. And his terms were that there was to be, the Russians were to allow an independent road to communism, and this is what Tito has been following. What did he do? They started all sorts of things like self-management in the factories, which still goes on, perhaps not so successfully, but I notice it's being copied in a lot of other parts of the world. Decentralization of economic power. They moved from a command economy to a market economy. The place was flooded with consumer goods. Very nice, too. Everybody has a washing machine. I haven't seen washing up machines, but I'm sure they'll come any minute now. And sharing of political power within the Communist Party. The Communist Party was not to be an elite that dictated everything. They were to share power. Now, most of these things were not very successful. Decentralization proved a terrible snare because the different parts of Yugoslavia leapt on decentralization that they'd been longing for half a century. And they decentralized so much that they said the party started to quarrel about political power. Particularly, it started to quarrel about money, about taxation, about investments, and so on. With the result that by 1970, it looked as if Yugoslavia was going to break up, and as if the Communist Party, there were six Communist parties for the six regions of the country and not one. And Tito then looked at what he had done and decided that as he was getting an old man, it was probably a mistake. And it's interesting that Tito had a very nasty lesson in international relations within the communist world by what had happened to Hungary in 1956 and to Czechoslovakia in 1968. And he wished to stop the rot in Yugoslavia before the Russians had an excuse for invading. Now, whether the Russians would have invaded, they don't have a common frontier or not, I do not know. But this I will come back to in a minute. But he himself took charge of the situation. And since 1971, he has been trying to crack down on excessive decentralization, on loss of power by the party, and re-centralizing power, and getting it back into the kind of shape that he had it in earlier years. It was easier said than done. I'm not sure. Certainly, re-centralization and certain amount of change in market economy they still have, but certain amount of change in the power of the party and of the economic system, re-centralization of the economic system has taken place. But Tito is still left with this difficult situation that the country is not centralized. There is a lot of dissatisfaction in the regions. There is a shifting of power within the party all the time, and Tito is getting older and older. And all this has been taking place and is taking place against the background of relations with the Soviet Union. Relations with the Soviet Union have never been very good. They have been on a seesaw between apparent cordiality and very marked hostility. And when there is great hostility, Tito turns to the West for aid, but he is unable to throw in his lot with the West. He cannot join NATO and ask them to support him against a possible Soviet invasion later, because if he did, it would be possible for the Russians to say, this man is no communist, and he would be untrue to his communist ideals. So he can't line up with the West, and he can't line up with Russia, because that would be to give up his independent line and give up everything that he stood for the past 30 years. So he walks a tightrope. And as he gets nearer the end of his act, as you might say, the tightrope walk doesn't get easier, it gets more difficult. And if he's ever been tempted to go back into the fold, he only has to look at Hungary and Czechoslovakia and see what happened to the Hungarian leaders, to Nagy and to Dubček, and to know that if he went back, that would be the end of him. He says that he would fight if Russia took a strong line against anything that happened in Yugoslavia. And no doubt he would, and no doubt he would have the authority and the leadership still to do it at whatever great age he might be in, if the situation arose today. Would the Yugoslavs fight? I believe they would, if they were faced by a Russian invasion. All preparations are made for fighting, even down to a kind of citizens' home guard army in every area of the country. Would the Western Allies help if Yugoslavia was invaded? I wonder, where would they help from? Could America help? Could the United States help? I very much wonder. Would other satellites revolt? Would Romania revolt? Would Poland revolt? Would Hungary revolt? Czechoslovakia? It's possible, but they might not. Russian troops would be deployed there straight away. They might not be able to. Would China attack Russia in the east? After Mao's death, China is very weak, so Yugoslavia's position is not a very strong one vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. Therefore, as long as Tito is alive, and the longer he lives, longer the crisis situation is postponed, as long as Tito is alive, it is unlikely that the Russians will invade. But I don't think there's any doubt at all that the Russians have watched the developments in Yugoslavia, the liberalization that Tito has introduced, the rejecting of Russian authority, which can probably never be restored totally. Tito's lack of military support to the Soviet Union. He won't support the Warsaw Pact. And the kind of communism which rejects the monolithic Russian leadership. This is the big sin of Titoism. And there is no doubt that the Russians must now, at this minute, be making their plans for what they're going to do when Tito actually departs from this scene. Well, Tito has known this, he knows it, he discusses it, and has organized for it. One of the things that he has tried to do is to make a strong sort of third world grouping, which has been called the non-alignment movement. They started that way back in the early 1960s. 1961 conference in Belgrade with Nehru, Nasser, Sukarno, Nkrumah, Haile Selassie. Where are they all now, these great leaders? All gone except Tito. The non-alignment movement today has 81 members, but there are many of them states of Africa and the Middle East who are themselves in disarray and not in agreement, and they certainly don't make a united front from which Yugoslavia could expect any real help, maybe in voting in the United Nations, but certainly not any help against Russia. So that Yugoslavia still really is on its own as it was when Tito took it over. Now, just to conclude, if I have two more minutes, I'd like to say a few words about Tito the man, Tito this great revolutionary. It's very difficult to give an impression about him. He certainly gives you the feeling of being a great man when you meet him, but you go in with preconceptions anyway. He talks with enormous self-confidence, without boasting. He doesn't pose. He doesn't appear to be acting, though he may be acting Tito, I don't know. But he certainly doesn't pose or talk down. He has never, to my knowledge, refused to answer a question, however difficult the questions. He may, of course, have withheld information. This I'm sure he has done. But he's a man of great charm and great self-confidence. And he is a man of stature. You feel that here is somebody who is quite exceptional. He's small. He's good-looking, though he's very old now, highly intelligent, very quick, can converse in various languages simultaneously. He's, I would suppose, a very good intuitive judge of people. He's undoubtedly ruthless, and you feel the steel glove is not far, steel hand is not far from the velvet glove. You feel you wouldn't like to cross this man. They say he's good-natured. He has a temper, I know. One example that I happened when I was in Belgrade once was when he was giving a banquet for NASA and falling over himself to get NASA's friendship. And they served the usual very splendid meal. And at the end of it, they were serving oranges, which were cut into the shape of water lilies, with Jaffa written largely on the bottom of the orange. And I'm quite certain somebody was fired for that. terrible temper. Another incident, again, was I remember when I was in Belgrade, was when there was a showdown about the excessive decentralization, and he was calling in all the Yugoslav party members in order to give them a dressing down and to knock their heads together and say, decentralization has finished. Excessive, and he was going to fire the heads of the Croatian party, which he did, followed by firing the heads of the Serbian party. But they were all called to a place called Karadjordjevo. Well, Karadjordjevo is a name of which there are a number of places in Yugoslavia, and one poor fellow had a chauffeur in a black Mercedes, as all these big communist leaders did, who took him to the wrong Karadjordjevo. So, of course, he arrived very late. He, too, was fired, and the chauffeur, too, I expect. Now, he has a sense of humour. He likes fun. He likes these sort of rather old-fashioned pranks. When Lord Snowden visited Yugoslavia with Princess Margaret, they played rather rude pranks on him, like cups that had a hole in them, you know, that you have to, and cushions that you sit on, and those sort of things. And he thought this was very funny. He turns out to be, he is, and always has been, a very good athletic person. He was 50 in the worst year of the war, 1942, and he did everything. He did the same and starved like the rest of his soldiers. Now, even at 84 now, he's a splendid rider and an excellent shot, better than some of the royalty that visit him and that have spent all their lives. Perhaps he too spent all his life shooting, so no doubt he's a good shot, but he still retains this. And he's still very disciplined. He works very hard. He gets up. He wears out about three or four aides a day. He works for about 16 hours or more, but has little cat naps and times off in between. But he keeps his aide. He wears out the people who work for him because he's such a hard worker. And it's this attention to detail. It must be weakening. I have not seen him, of course, for about 5 years now. But I know people who work for him. And, of course, now when I'm assured how well he is and how active he is and so on, I feel that perhaps there's a little bit of protesting about this because his powers must be weakening a bit. But he is still sufficiently in control to be indisputable master in his own house and indisputable master in Yugoslavia. Now, after him, what's going to happen? There is no one man to succeed that I can see. And indeed, I think one-man rulership is out of date in Europe, though perhaps not in underdeveloped countries, I don't know. If the revolution that he's created is to continue, and the regions are not to demand autonomy and break away, there will have to be a very tight organization when Tito dies, because the Russians will obviously take this as a time to try and turn it over. They will try from within, I think it's likely, try to create dissension within the party, Yugoslav party, so that they can pick out a group who will support the Russians coming in so that they can come in and set order in Yugoslavia. So obviously they're organizing in order to prevent this, and probably military control will be necessary until the crisis period is over. Tito is really, he's a conservative in spite of all that we say about him being a revolutionary leader. He's lived beyond his generation, and I think that many of the dangers and internal and external which he has had to face have not been entirely eradicated, and it is impossible for the problems that he's dealt with to have a solution. There has to be another solution and other solutions, and these will have to be dealt with by the people who come after him. He's led a rich and colorful life, and he's survived spectacular dramas in his life, and whether you approve of him or not, it has to be admitted that his influence has radically changed the history that we call Titoism after Tito, has really changed the history of international communism in our times.
It's hard to imagine that there's anything left unsaid about Tito and Yugoslavia, but Dr. Audi has agreed to answer questions in accordance with our normal practice. Yes?
What are the possibilities for internal dissension after Tito?
I think there are big possibilities. I think that the regions are... there's still a lot of dissatisfaction. I think there are big possibilities for dissension between Croatia and Serbia. I think the Slovenes would line up with the idea that they should have more autonomy. The Macedonians probably too. But the question is, will the people who have grievances realize that would they prefer to break up the country and allow the Russians in, or would they prefer to compose their differences, even if they're not totally satisfied, and keep the Russians out?
Yes.
Yes, I'm somewhat puzzled that there hasn't been more cooperation between Yugoslavia and Albania, another maverick, another guy, where it seems the logical thing could have been some comments. Another one is, what does the name Tito mean, and why did he have to adopt that name?
Well, can I take them in reverse order?
Could you repeat it so the others could hear it?
Did you hear the question? What does the name Tito mean? And there was one question. And the second question was, why has there not been more cooperation between Yugoslavia and Albania, both mavericks? I'd answer the first question first, because I asked Tito this. I said, is it true that it was a name that was given during the war? Tito, you do that. And various things that have been said. He said, not at all, absolute rubbish. He said, it was a common name in the area in which I was brought up. And in fact, I have found in documents in 1934, as a member of the Yugoslav Underground Committee in Exile, it says, committee meeting, so-and-so, 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 Gorkic, Tito. So that it had nothing to do with the war. Now, as to Albania, relations between Albania and Yugoslavia have been very bad since the war. During the war, the Yugoslavs helped the Albanians in their guerrilla activities. And at the end of the war, Yugoslavia behaved to Albania rather as Russia was behaving to Yugoslavia. They tried to use them as a satellite. And the Albanians were very bitter about this. And so came the common form, expulsion of Tito. The Albanians lined up with the Russians, but then they rounded up with the Russians, the Albanians, and they had the Chinese in. And I think now that, I think there's still Chinese there. Albania is frightened to ally with Yugoslavia, frightened because they'll be swallowed up. There is also a very large Albanian and an increasingly large Albanian minority in Kosovo, Polia, and in Macedonia. And Albania would like to take over this heartland of Serbia, as you might say, the place where all their most dramatic history was fought out against the Turks in the 14th century. And this is a sort of historic spot, but it's now occupied entirely by, or not entirely, but almost entirely by Albanians. So Albania would like to take over that area. And the Albanians are, in any case, afraid that the Yugoslavs would try to take them over. But of recent years, relations have improved a little bit. It's now possible to go from Yugoslavia to Albania without being shot as you cross the lake from Ohrid. And there is a certain amount of trade going on between the two countries, but very cautious.
Yes. Yes.
I regret to say this, I was very disappointed with your lecture because you had many holes in it, especially in the period between 1941 and 1949, which is, I guess, most important the period of Tito's reign. Let me ask you this, how do you, as an expert in Yugoslavia and Tito and his communism, obtain your information?
How do I obtain my information? Well, obviously a historian obtains information in a lot of different ways. About the war, there's a great deal of information available now from original documents, German documents, Italian documents, British documents, American documents, and so on. I have seen the Comintern documents about Yugoslavia. I interview people on both sides of the fence. I have interviewed Yugoslavs support Tito, Yugoslavs against Tito, I use whatever material I can find that I don't regard as prejudiced, too prejudiced. I make a historian's judgment on the material that I use. What were you thinking of?
I was thinking of that because information course, tends to be very subjective, right? And I was very disappointed that I didn't hear anything about what happened to the people, both fascists and communists, that were in opposition to Tito.
That was not the subject of my lecture. The subject of my lecture was Tito as an international revolutionary leader, and in an hour you have to be selective. I was not dealing with Chetniks and partisans. That would be another subject, because there's an enormous amount of material and a lot of matters for discussion in that subject. I think it does. I think everything that they do throws light on them. And but you can only be selective in a period of 1 hour. I therefore had to select what I thought was apposite to the subject that we were under discussion.
Yes.
Professor Audley, would you say that those workers that he is allowed to go out of Yugoslavia into Europe at large would be a group whose loyalty he could rely on, or would they be in the opposition?
I think that's an interesting question. The question was, do I think that the workers who have gone out of Yugoslavia, that's over a million workers, have gone out of Yugoslavia as Gastarbeiter, would be loyal to Tito as a group. Is that right? I don't think that they are a monolithic group. I don't think that you can say that they would all be one group. I do think that a great many of them who have worked in Germany and who have made a lot more money in Germany than they would either have been able to make in Yugoslavia or been allowed to keep in Yugoslavia would prefer to stay out, or if they go back, to be able to keep more than they're allowed to keep. Now, if they went back to Yugoslavia, or if the question is put on Tito's death, what do you want afterwards? They too will have to face the issue of, do they want the Russians in? Do they want Yugoslavia to break up? Or what kind of government are they prepared to support? I think a lot of them would be against communism. I think a lot of them have seen West German government and seen the kind of democratic government that is in other parts of Europe, which is less restricted than the communism in Yugoslavia, and I think they would like it. But whether they would be able to have it in Yugoslavia is another matter. And this is the question they would have to answer. I don't think there would be one answer. I think that I was asked, why do I always stress the Russians coming in? Do I not think that the Americans might go in? My answer to that is that the Yugoslavs would almost certainly be delighted if the Americans would go in. But the question is, what base would they go from? The Mediterranean fleet? German troops, American troops in Germany? From NATO? The NATO allies, Greece and Turkey, are very shaky. I think the Americans would consider, just as the British would, just as the Canadians would, that the Adriatic is a very important strategic place, even now, even in the atomic age, and that Yugoslavs would hope for American aid, but I did at one stage in the evening say, would they give it? And I leave this as a query because I don't know the answer.
When some immigrants trained in Australia and in Canada and dropped by the slaves in Yugoslavia in 1971?
These were opponents of these were opponents, but they were, I think these are a very small, very peripheral group. I don't think that they have any major importance in the issues that will take place when Tito dies unless they would get a lot of help in the country. And this, they would get some help, they would almost certainly get, but there would be, it would split the country. And splitting the country is the way the Russians would come in, probably not the way the Americans would come in. I've been asked if, I think this is right, if the divisions that exist in present-day Yugoslavia have been caused by Tito's policy, particularly by his economic policy. Is that right? Yes. Or did they exist before? Well, my answer to that is that these divisions existed very crucially and deeply in pre-war Yugoslavia, and they have deep historical roots, and that at the end of the war, during the war, people were battered into, in opposing the Germans, they were battered into unity, and they sort of hypnotized. They were hypnotized into saying that they were unified, and everything was made to look like centralized unity, and underneath this, the old divisions still existed. And when you got industrialization in the country, the areas that before the war had been more industrialized went ahead more rapidly, they had more to invest, and therefore the divisions were accentuated. Therefore, industrialization, Tito's policy, but industrialization by any other name would have accentuated these differences. And I think it true to say that the policy of decentralization allowed people to express their differences, and that this in itself may have made the differences, I don't know whether it made them worse or more apparent, but it allowed alternatives to be expressed by extremists. I think that the policy has perhaps accentuated differences that would have been there anyway. The religious differences are perhaps lessened, economic differences increased. I think this would have come in any case by whatever kind of economic industrialization problem you had had in program you would have had in Yugoslavia. I don't see one solution to it. I find it very difficult to answer that question. The followers of Mihailovich, could I say what happened to all the followers of Mihailovich? The answer is no, I can't answer it. It's too complicated. I can give a very simplistic answer and say that some followers of Mihailovich left with the German army at the end of the war or by other means. Some who were declared war criminals were executed, a very small proportion. I don't know the total numbers of the emigration, of the people who went out. Obviously some people who supported the Chetniks, a lot of people who supported the Chetniks, must have stayed and accepted, lived through, perhaps awaiting some sort of chance. I don't know. I think that the Mihailovich movement was virtually destroyed by the end of 43, and it was basically Serbian. it was not Yugoslav, and so it affected, on the whole, only a small part of the country. I'm sure he doesn't. I'm sure he hasn't got a successor. I think he believes that a successor would be a dangerous thing to have, because in the situation that we've just discussed of great divisions within Yugoslavia and strong local feeling, which can only be satisfied by autonomy, it can't be satisfied by centralization, I think in that situation, there is no one person who is acceptable as Tito is. Tito is half Croat, half Slovene. He has never, ever been associated with any one area of the country, not even with the area that he was born in. He has always appealed to a Yugoslav, said we must unite, we must keep the country together. But when I said to him last time I saw him, do you believe in Yugoslavism? He said, almost sort of spitting, he said, Yugoslavism, he said, that doesn't exist and it won't exist for a very long time. And his aide looked at him and obviously thought that he shouldn't have been saying something as honest as that. But he believes that Yugoslavia is a unit, but Yugoslavism isn't. That you are either a Croat or a Serb or a Bosnian or whatever. And therefore, I think what has been prepared for when he dies is not a one-man succession, but a rotating succession. In the new constitution, a committee will take over, and that committee will have to represent not only the different regions of the country, but also the different power groups within the party, and this is extremely complicated. And the major question nobody has yet asked me is, where does the army stand in all this? And I'm quite sure that the question of whether the army is divided into regional groupings or ideological groupings or pro-Soviet and anti-Soviet groupings is vital to the whole story of what will happen afterwards. I personally don't. Bjedic was a Bosnian. He was somebody who was just taking his turn. It was Buggin's turn, really. They take turns each republic and group of people take the post premiership in turn, and the premier is not a very strong post in Yugoslavia. It's usually somebody being kicked upstairs.
Yes.
Question is very interesting. It is, has Tito got his own personal ideas about foreign policy? And this points one of these holes in my talk, which the gentleman up there referred to, of which there were very many. He was quite correct. In his external policy, his foreign affairs, I would say that Tito has been very individual. It's the one part of policy that he has kept to himself. Into his own hands, I mean. He has discussed it with his cabinet, but it has always been led and formulated by him. And I think non-alignment was his own idea, which he strongly supported. Now, he's followed Russian policy when it has not affected Yugoslavia's national interests. He has put Yugoslavia's national interests first. You couldn't say that it was a communist policy. It was a nationalist policy. His foreign policy has been absolutely what you would expect any Yugoslav government, thinking of Yugoslavia's strategic needs, its political needs, that it was very strongly nationalist. But where Yugoslavia's needs for port like Trieste or for protection of the Adriatic coast or whatever were not concerned, he's then been prepared to throw a bone to the Russians and support them, often supported them in the United Nations in their votes. He, in particular in the Middle East, it's a very interesting point, the Middle East, because in the Middle East he has been strongly pro-Arab and strongly anti-Israel. And you could say, and some people do say, that this was because he was friendly with Nasser. I don't really think this is so. You see, Israel is actually more socialist than the Arab states or than Egypt, but he didn't choose the socialist. He didn't make the socialist choice. He didn't back the socialists, Israel. He backed if you look at the sheikhdoms, I mean, you couldn't see, say that that is anything more than strong one-man rule. He backed the Arab side. Now, I think that it's more likely, partly because he wanted Nasser's support, he wanted for his non-alignment movement, the small states. Israel, not so useful. All these countries, if they would back together, would be a lot of votes if they would vote together. But also, on this occasion, he could support the Russian point of view. But I will tell you one thing, that when the Russians were strong, when they were strong in Egypt, and they were sending a lot of supplies to Egypt, and they were dominating Egyptian policy, Tito was very nervous, and the Yugoslavs were very nervous, because they thought this would bring the Russians into the Mediterranean, which it did, and would then they would have control over the Adriatic from the Mediterranean. And so even that policy is not safe, you see. Non-alignment might therefore be considered as partly a sop to Russia, but also a weapon against Russia.
I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but I've got to exercise my discretion and say no more questions. You've been going for nearly the entire speech time again in questions. And as the speaker has said to us tonight, there is material for at least one, probably two more lectures, and we'll try and get her back again for you. I'm going to ask Mr. J.V. Klein if he'll be good enough to thank our speaker.
Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, I confess that I am also disappointed tonight because I had always thought that Phyllis Horthy did parachute into Yugoslavia during the war. And I had hoped to be able to say that we would look forward to her dropping in to see us frequently. But even if she is not a parachutist, she is a very distinguished historian. And we are fortunate in having her as part of the university community in Simon Fraser. Her book on Tito, which I read some time ago, is an authoritative work on one of the very interesting and forceful characters of our time. It has been published in a number of different languages. I'm not her literary agent, but it is an excellent work. It was banned in Yugoslavia, and I'm sorry to contradict one of my former brother judges, but it has now been published in Yugoslavia.
No, Jack.
Hasn't it? You told me
no,
it had.
No,
you told me you went there. Well, in any event, we should have, it should have been published, and in any event, she has now written another book, which will explain what she was doing in Yugoslavia during the time of the war. I think we must all take a certain amount of satisfaction in what she told us about the difficulties that Yugoslavia is experiencing internally, because it is nice to know that other countries besides Canada have their internal difficulties. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, may I, on your behalf, thank Phyllis Auty for a very interesting and informative talk about Tito and Yugoslavia.
Well, that ends our meeting tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Come again next Saturday night, and when you'll hear the Dr. Kennedy talking about computers. If you're as terrified of computers as I am, you should come and listen to what they're doing to us.